Welcome, everyone. Episode 383 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to continue on with our season preview for the 2020-2021 season. As a reminder, we're breaking these up based on where teams finished last year. So today we are going to talk about the Western Conference playoff teams from last season. Before we get into all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we are recording this one live on the Locker Room app. So if you are on iOS, download the Locker Room app. You can come listen live, ask us questions, even come up on stage with us. It's a lot of fun. So download Locker Room on iOS, and if you're on Android, they are working on a version for that as well. With all of that said, I am joined today by someone who is in a slightly better mood, who claimed he was doing decently today. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
Well, I mean, look, decently in 2020, is that not good in every other year?
That's fair. Yeah. That's actually like a 9 out of 10 most of the time.
Yeah, like for this year, I think decently is like the best case scenario. No, but I am doing decently, and I have full disclosure, I may actually throw up during this episode, and I'll tell you why. Because it's Friday, and in my family we don't eat a lot of McDonald's. We really don't. And I decided on my way home from work, I was like, I'm going to surprise the family because there's a McDonald's close by. I'm gonna bring food home. So I bought a bunch of burgers, shakes, McNuggets, whatnot, right? And I come home, and my wife sees the bags, and she looks at me, and she's like, I think you've forgotten something. I'm like, did I forget to buy something? And she's like, no, think, you idiot. She didn't say that, but her eyes did. And then I realized, just a couple days ago, my oldest son, Bruce, had told us that he wanted to become a vegetarian. I had completely forgotten about that. So there I am, coming home with a ton of burgers and shakes and, you know, nuggets and everything. Mm-hmm. And that poor kid sees the McDonald's logo, right? And he's just like, Dad, come on. Which, first and foremost, that was really poor parenting on my part. And kudos to him, because like, he could have caved and just said, you know what? No, screw it. I'm going to have a burger. He didn't. He stayed away. Like, and I'm very impressed. But as you might know, McDonald's tend to not really be that good the day after. And I knew that. And McDonald's here in Denmark, let me add, is not inexpensive by any means. That is, it is very expensive, actually. And so I decided, well, given the context of things, I really should not leave anything to chance, or just leave it and let it go bad or whatever. So I decided, fine, it's Friday. I can handle. I'm a big man. I can handle it.
Oh no.
Yeah, I could not handle it. I cannot handle it right now. There are three burgers in the fridge, which are undoubtedly going to taste horribly tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But that's where I am.
Good,
because I'm an idiot.
Well, you could have just told Bruce that it was one of those plant-based burgers, so I'm proud of you for not lying to him, at least.
I'm glad that's the threshold you're holding me to. That's the standard. Yeah. I'm proud that you're not lying to your own child. Yeah.
Well, I'm just glad my wife is asleep and isn't hearing this conversation, because she has been craving a McFlurry for months. So if she heard that you had gotten...
Oh, for months? Months.
Yeah, this has been a long-running battle in the Toporek household, so I am exceedingly grateful. She is working an overnight shift tonight, and so she is asleep right now. And I'm very grateful she is not hearing this conversation. So let's move on before she wakes up.
How can you not give your wife a McFlurry? That's husband points right
there.
We
stopped at a McDonald's one day, and she didn't get one. It's not on me. This is her own poor decision-making.
Okay, but she's been craving it for months. That's when you step up as a man and a husband and go, you know what? I'm going to surprise the ever-living hell out of her with, like, two McFlurries. There you go, sweetheart.
Christmas.
Happy Friday.
Christmas is coming up. That's all I'm saying. easiest Christmas I've ever had.
Oh, poor Alex. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, boy. Let's get into it because we have a lot of teams to hit today. So again, we're going to just go through the Western Conference. We're going 8-1, and this is just based on how they finished last year. We are not saying these eight teams are going to make the playoffs this year because I know at least one of them will not. We'll start with the Portland Trail Blazers, who won their number 8 spot in the bubble. They were entered the bubble 3.5 games back. They ended up surging up the standings because Damian Lillard is just an absolute monster. Won the play-in game as well. I mean, we talked about them as one of the bigger winners of the offseason, bringing in Robert Covington, getting Enes Kanter, right, re-signing Rodney Hood, re-signing Carmelo. So I think it's safe to say we're both relatively high on the Blazers compared to last year. But how important do you think Covington's going to be for this team?
Huge. Huge, man. I mean, we've talked a little bit about it before. This is a guy who can guard multiple positions, who can shoot the three at a high volume. And yes, okay, the results are varying to some degree. I mean, you, of all people, know because you followed him so closely back in Philly. He's not, you know, one of those reliable 43% shooters. Nope. He's not that kind. Like, he will give you a performance one night where he goes 6 of 8. Yep. And then he'll go 1 for 7 the other. And while that is inconsistent to a certain point, I think overall it does average out to being above, you know, above league average, at least to the point where you when you consider volume, he becomes a 3-point shooter you really dare. You really don't want to dare like be open, like you rush out to close off of him. And that's just offensively. Defensively, he can pretty much do everything. You know, he's a shot blocker. He can get ball. He can get steals on the ball, off the ball, and it's not just like steals and blocks. It's positioning, defensive IQ, communication. I really think he is the type of guy who can, you know, glue a team together. And for the Blazers in particular, who've needed this glue guy on their team for a while. Especially at the wing slot, he fits right in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you could have found a better wing than him for Dame and CJ specifically. And then when you throw Jusuf Nurkić into the equation, I mean, there you have a top four that is just ruthlessly efficient. Mm-hmm. And overall should be one of the best four-man combinations in the NBA next season.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the impact that Trevor Ariza had on the Blazers last year, and, mm-hmm. you know, this is not Trevor Ariza in his prime. This is Trevor Ariza who's been traded 3 times in the last 2 weeks. Four times. That might be, yeah.
Was it? I don't even know. Three or four times.
Robert Covington is a much better player than Trevor Ariza at this stage of their respective careers. He is not an elite on-ball defender. He's not a lockdown Kawhi type, but off the ball, he's just an absolute terror. Like, he is going to create at least one or two easy buckets per game just by darting into passing lanes, breaking up passes, creating steals, dishing to Dame and CJ, and just letting him run the break. Also, I like the versatility that he's going to bring to this team. We saw it in Houston where he even played some small ball five. I don't know that he needs to do that in Portland necessary because he has Nurkić and now Enes Kanter, but I mean, I'm assuming he's going to start at the three, and either Carmelo or Zach Collins can start at the four, but you could very easily play him as a small ball four with Rodney Hood at the three, Gary Trent Jr. at the three, whatever. So, I mean, I think his addition to the team is going to give them a lift on both ends of the court, and it gives Terry Stotts a lot more flexibility in terms of, you know, lineup creation, figuring out, okay, different looks at different times. We're going against the Lakers. We need two bigs. Covington can slide to the three. We're going against the Clippers. They're a wing-heavy team. All right, cool. He'll play the four. We'll get, you know, more shooting, more wings out on there. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's going to be huge for this team. You know, obviously a healthy Nurkić. Like, when he came back in the bubble, it didn't look like he had lost a step. He looked phenomenal. So that's going to be a big deal for them. And then, Mort, I know you have been in love with the Blazers' young guys for a while now, so I got to give you a chance to talk about, you know, Gary Trent Jr., Anthony Simons, Nasir Little. How do you see them rounding out this Blazers bench?
Well, you're laughing, but I told you about Gary Trent Jr. Before he became Gary Trent Jr.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I told you. I was high on him. Admittedly, I was higher on Simons than I was Trent Jr. And that, so far, the jury is still out, admittedly. But he's going into year three. I think there's something there. He can put the ball in the basket. He's still very, very raw. Mm-hmm. This is the biggest year for him because he's coming into year three. They're still going to need some depth at the guard spots. He is a guy who can put the ball in the basket. He's not, I think, necessarily a guy who'll run the offense, which does make me wonder if he could be a trade candidate near the trade deadline for a more classic point guard, if you will. I hope that's not the case because I like Simons, and I hope over the course of this long, well, not long layoff for them necessarily because they played in the bubble, but I'm hoping that he comes back with some more point guard skills. Mm-hmm. That would be nice. I think that's what he needs to be able to like balance his game out. Trent Jr., I mean, we've already seen what he can do. Great shooter, great defender. There's definitely a higher ceiling connected to him than anyone really thought of him initially. So he has to be one of the primary guys in that core moving forward. Nasir Little is still, much like Simons, very, very raw. He's entering his second year. I like the energy, and I wonder if the best course of action for him right now is just basically become that Joakim Noah type guy off the bench for them, just a guy who comes in limited minutes, yells and screams and provides you know, a lot of energy and rebounds the heck out of the ball. And when he goes up for a dunk, just, you know, throws it down just a little bit harder just to gain some momentum, so just to gain some energy, like get people on his side. I think that's what he is right now. Unless, of course, he just spent the last couple of months really straightening out his skill set. And if he comes into this Blazers team and provides a legitimate role, provides the play of a legitimate role player in the sense that he's making the right reads defensively, you know, he's being able to handle the ball a little bit more, his shots improved, like his skill level, if that is increased, I mean, then we're talking about Portland potentially being a top two team in the West.
That was my next question, because we've seen, I mean, we saw last year they were the eighth seed, but they had, you know, Hood went down early-ish, Collins went down super early, they didn't have Nurkic until the bubble, so like, you know, a right. half-strength Blazers team. And we saw once they got those guys back, or most of those guys back, we saw what they could accomplish in the bubble. So do you think this Blazers team is a legit threat for top three, top four seed in the West?
I don't see why not. And I realize that I'm always high on the Blazers, and you always make fun of me when they don't live up to my hype. So I'm open for that again. I am putting myself in the firing range here because I just like them. I like the way that they have their internal structure in terms of chemistry. I think they run a tight ship. I think Dame is one of the most underappreciated players in the NBA. I actually think the same of CJ, just in a little bit different way. I like what they have. I like their roster. I like their you know, their togetherness. And I think they play the right way. I mean, it's not as if they just take threes or they just look for certain shots. They play very much like the Warriors in their when they were great, in the terms of they're not turning down open shots. Mm-hmm. Like if the defense is going to give you something, they take it. And that's the way I think basketball needs to be played as well. Like, don't force a certain shot if the defense is conceding something. You know, and I'm not saying, hey, take 20-foot you know, jump shots. That's not what I'm saying. But like, if there's a driving lane open, okay, take it. Like, utilize it. If the defense make a mistake, you know, capitalize on it. And I think the Blazers are one of those teams that are really good at doing that. So I could see this just being one of those years where they put everything together and they have you know, one of those Sacramento Kings in 2002 kind of years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, 2 years ago they were in the Western Conference Finals. So I think, you know, you say I make fun of you a lot for your Blazers faith, but this year I'm right along with you. I think this, you know, I think you phrased it well. I don't see why they couldn't be a top four seed. Now the West is just the West. It's so deep and one injury can derail anything. So I'm not saying they are a top four lock. I don't think you can say that about any team really, but assuming good health, yes, I think the Blazers are going to be a lot better this year in the regular season than they were last year. I would not want to play them in the first round of the playoffs, and I'm excited to see them. They are, you know, we'll do our league pass rankings in a couple weeks. They're going to be very high on my list this year, given the combination of, you know, veteran experience, but then seeing how these young guys develop too. And I was just looking at their depth chart. They don't have a single player older than me. Which makes this is like the midlife crisis that I've been staving off. I think they're
well. Welcome to my world.
None of their players have been born before 1990, so that's cool. So maybe I actually I changed my mind. I hate the Blazers because they just made me feel old.
Now I think for them the top, you know, the top potential is a top two seed, right? I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I think. I think it could happen.
Yeah, if everything breaks right and, like, you know, the Clippers take a step back, the Nuggets take a step back. Exactly. I don't see why not.
Right, exactly, and that's you know, that's being optimistic.
Right.
In terms of being more realistic, yes, a top four seed. Like if they're the top fourth, you know, the number four in the West. I don't necessarily think it takes, you know, a great amount of optimism to project them as there. They had a legitimately great offseason. They have a great roster. I would almost go as far as saying, like, if they end up with the 7th seed or 8th seed, I would be disappointed.
Yeah. Well, again, assuming they stay healthy.
Right.
Yes, if healthy, I think it is more likely they end up in the top four than 7 or 8. So let's go one spot up more to the Dallas Mavericks, and we have to start, of course, with Luka Doncic, who was phenomenal in his second season. What do you expect out of him this year? Do you think he can be a legit MVP candidate?
Do you want me to answer that, or do you want me to answer that when we have our award spot?
Teaser.
But do you want me to answer that right now, or because I'll let you ask a different question so I don't ruin the answer.
No, I mean, you could go into it now. We can revisit in the awards pod as well. But so it's not, you're picking Luka MVP this year, it sounds like.
I am. Now, I'll say as much. When I've fallen into this trap before, and this is way back in 2000. So before the 2000-2001 season, I was sure as hell that third-year pro Vince Carter would win the MVP. I even went into like a contest that XXL Basketball the magazine, which I think was a European-based magazine, had. I even entered that contest at the age of 14, and I said it's gonna be Vince Carter because that was the question: who will win the MVP? And I was like, Vince. I even believe I was so arrogant. I was like, what's his middle? It's Vincent Lamar Carter, right?
I don't know. Sure.
I definitely found his full name and I put it in. Like, I knew that was going to be Vince, right? So because of that, I'm a little bit hesitant to actually put Luka in as my MVP just because of bad childhood memories.
That's fair.
But if there's a guy who could overcome that, it's Luka. Like, the dude was pretty much 30-10-10 in his second season.
Yeah.
Now, if he comes back with an improved jump shot, and if he comes back with improved defense, and I'm not saying DPOY level whatsoever, just better, more refined, and his shooting is more refined, and he becomes the 40% three-point shooter that I think he can be, I don't see a reason why he couldn't be. If the Mavericks finishes in like the top three or even top four in the West, he's right there. I mean, absolutely. The question we should be asking is, can he be the face of the league if he's only shooting 31% from downtown and 75% from the line? Hashtag Yoda.
Right.
Yeah. That reference will go over the heads of so many people. And good. Honestly, right, exactly. For the people that it goes over, you should be glad that it does.
Yeah,
right?
Do not do sleuthing into what it means, because you'll just get sad by basketball grifters.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, look, you're right. The stats, even last year, were there individually. The Mavericks had a historically great offense as well. They were great in crunch time games. Like, the foundation is certainly there for him to be in the mix, if not among the front runners. I think one of the concerns for the Mavericks is that Kristaps Porzingis had surgery on his knee. I believe he's out until at least January. So how do you think they make up for the loss of him over those first few weeks?
More Luka is one thing, but they did get Josh Richardson in there. Mm-hmm. And I think you can funnel more shots to Richardson. I think you can, as long as it's not in the way of him having to create them like he did in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not a primary on-ball creator. He's just not. But having Luka next to him could free him up a little bit more. The offense is a little bit more loose. He's not in Philly anymore, so he should be able to hit three-point shots now. So I think he'll carry more of that. And you know, it saddens me a little bit that I won't be able to say, well, Seth Curry's got this.
Yeah. But
I know he's on your team now, and I know you're very happy about that, as you should be. But I will miss him in Dallas greatly, because I think that was just such a perfect combination. Like, Luka and Seth Curry, they were lethal.
Yeah.
Like, Luka would get those high screens from somebody, and he would start driving. He would read the entire floor, and sometimes he would just place himself in a certain way, knowing full well, just baiting Seth's guy to come over and help. And whenever he did, he always had like this smile on his lips, like, yeah, got you. Shoot, bullet pass down the corner to wide open Seth, who was like, money.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss that very, very much, because that was one of those plays I just loved observing. So Richardson is one. I think Jalen Brunson, depending on health as well, could be interesting. Entering third year, there is some talent there. There is some significant talent, which I think could be utilized. Obviously, you're probably looking for a guy like Tim Hardaway Jr., and I'm not saying he can't, but there is still that part of me that wonders, can he duplicate what he did last season?
Mm-hmm. No, I think the Richardson call-out is smart. Zach Lowe had his like bounce-back candidates today, and naturally his first two were two former Sixers in Al Horford and Josh Richardson. And in the Richardson section, he said the first conversation that Richardson had with Rick Carlisle was basically Rick Carlisle reminding him that he's still good, which is exactly what you want to hear after he spends a year on your hometown team. But no, he was saying, like, the spacing in Philly obviously was just so bad that, you're going to Dallas now where, yes, they got rid of Seth Curry, they traded him for Josh Richardson, but they still have Luka, they still have Tim Hardaway, they have Tyrell Terry, who they are hoping to become Seth Curry 2.0.
So Josh Green?
Yeah. So, I mean,
Tyler Bay?
They have, I think what the Mavericks did this offseason was smart. Like, yes, we had a historically great offense, but our defense was nothing special. We basically made an offense for defense swap, bringing in Josh Green, bringing in Josh Richardson. So I expect them to be more stout on that end of the floor. I'm pleasantly surprised to hear Dwight Powell's already a full go. I did not expect that coming off of a torn Achilles.
Nope.
So, I mean, I think that will help defensively, especially with Kristaps being sidelined for a while. But, I think ultimately this team's going to go as far as Luka and KP take them, so they do need KP back and healthy at some point. I think they're just going to be kind of stemming the tide until he does return. So, I don't know that a top four seed is necessarily in the cards for them this year just because of his injury, but Again, talk about League Pass teams. Like, if Luka isn't in the top five of your League Pass, you're doing League Pass wrong.
Oh, you can probably guess where I have that.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, I can.
Yeah. Okay, but one note, because we always forget, or not we, because I love him, so I always make an effort to bring him up. But I think this is a guy who flies under the radar a lot. Maxi Kleber. He will probably take the vast majority of Porzingis' minutes. He'll probably start. And I think this is going to sound ridiculous, but just hear me out. I think in the terms of early returns, I think the Mavericks might even look a little bit better with him because he just does so many more things. Now, granted, Porzingis is arguably one of the best release valves in the NBA. Like, if you need a long shot, you can find him because he's got a 7'3" frame that you can find virtually everywhere, and he'll stroke that three.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no denying that, you know, offensively he's got a great talent, and defensively he's a shot blocker. I'm not denying his greatness. Maxi, however, is just one of those guys that allows everyone around him to play optimized ball. He's a great passer. He's a good defender. He's aggressive on the glass. He can roll. He can pop. He doesn't have a weakness that stands out. He's just solid in every aspect of the game. And I think playing that with, you know, that kind of game with Luka, where you minimize mistakes, where you just have this rock solid player alongside him in the lineup that doesn't swing wildly, which, you know, let's be fair, Porzingis can swing wildly. If he goes 0-for-8 from outside instead of going 6-of-7, you know, that's a vastly different product that he's providing you. I think Maxi has a more stable presence on the floor at all times, and that should, in theory, elevate Luka to a higher standard. So in that sense, I'm very excited to see what they'll do even without Porzingis.
Yeah. Let's go to the Utah Jazz, Mort, who, I mean, they were the Sixers of the West last year is the best way I could frame it. You know, they entered with such high expectations, you know, get Mike Conley, get Bojan Bogdanovic. Bojan played well. Mike Conley did not really until the bubble. So I think we should start with him. Do you think he can carry over the play that he had from the bubble where he actually looked like he had kind of figured some stuff out? Can he carry that over into this year, or is the Mike Conley we saw during most of the regular season, is that what we should expect moving forward?
No, I think we can expect him to carry over that play from the bubble, or at the very worst, somewhere in between that. You know, what we saw last year was an acclimation process. That was him figuring out to play for a new team after spending 10, 11, 12, how many years in Memphis? 12, right?
He came in 2007.
12. I'm looking it up.
Yeah, I think it's 12.
It was 12, yeah. Yes. And when you have played 12 seasons for a single franchise, and you suddenly, you know, find yourself with a different uniform, a whole new set of different teammates, new coach, new surroundings, new city. I mean, hell. Like, I get it. That's fair. It's an acclimation period. It's fine. And then he just kind of pivoted a little bit when the bubble began, and then he played better. Like, good. I fully expect him to just being able to put some time in between things and go, well, you know, I struggled, but I'm still Mike effing Conley. Like, I'm still here. I just need to be able to find my spots a little bit better. And now I've had over a year with this organization. I know the players involved. I know the coaching staff. I know the training staff. I know the medical staff. I know people now. Like, I'm comfortable. So I wouldn't be shocked whatsoever if Conley comes back this year and is vintage Conley.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be a running theme. We'll mention it a lot throughout these season previews, and then also just through the first few weeks of the season. I think the teams that have a lot of continuity rolling over from last year are going to have an advantage early on, just because we have such an abridged training camp and preseason, and they're just, you know, Dwight Howard was saying earlier this week, he's still learning people's names. Like, you know, how do you know you're going to have to run like a very vanilla playbook at the start of the year. There's probably not going to be a ton of practice time. Like, this is going to be a weird year because of COVID restrictions and, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the weeks and months to come. So
right.
I think, you know, having the Jazz are basically running it back with the addition of Derek Favors, who had played for them for a long time as well. So it's, you know, they have their core in place. There isn't going to be a lot of trying to figure out who likes the ball where. So yeah, I mean, I expect Conley to come back and be more like bubble Conley than regular season Conley from last year. Let's go into Favors then, because they brought him back on a 3-year, I believe it's $29.2 million, that's just the full mid-level exception. How do you see him fitting in here? Because, you know, we've seen the Favors Gobert lineups in years past just offensively really struggled. Do you think Favors is basically going to be the backup five and that's it? Or, like, will he spend some time with Gobert, just not a ton? Like, how would you manage that if you're Quinn Snyder?
Yeah, I would definitely stagger them as much as possible, but I don't think you can avoid overlap. You know, he's really good. That's something we always seem to forget about Derek Favors. He's a really good basketball player. And if you are playing Gobert in the vicinity of 32 minutes a game, there's no way in hell you can, like, let Favors settle for 16, because you would just be missing out on a whole lot of productivity during that time span. I would not advise you to do that. I think for him, it's a question of, what, you know, long term, what is my role here? Are we going to figure out a way where, you know, when Gobert is off the court, I'm the defensive anchor, and I basically take on his role, and we then have 48 minutes every single night where we have a defensive presence at the center position? If so, I think defensively the Jazz should be in really good hands. Or is this a situation of the Jazz thinking a little bit long term, going, well, in case we end up trading Rudy Gobert, then we have Derek Favors who can take over the five spot, and reliably so.
That is what I'm wondering as well, because Gobert, as we know, is up for he's eligible for a Supermax extension. I cannot imagine the Jazz are thrilled at the prospect of giving him such a huge deal, so maybe they'll agree to something smaller, and they have time to do that throughout the season. The Supermax deadline is December 21st, but they could agree to just a normal max at any point. But yeah, I mean, otherwise he's a free agent next offseason, and there's no indication that he wants to leave Utah. And, you know, there was the obvious the drama in March when the COVID stuff all started, and, you know, there was some tension between him and Donovan Mitchell. It seems like that is all blown over at this point. I think especially the last 9 months will have given everyone perspective about, you know, how no one person should be necessarily at fault or to blame. Like, Donovan can't be sure that Rudy Gobert gave him COVID or vice versa. So I don't think that's going to be an issue, but I am definitely wondering, you know, that's a lot of money to give Favors if you're just planning on playing him as a backup center. So it does seem to indicate that they're going to have to play him next to Favors next to Gobert at, you know, 10 minutes a night, maybe something like that. But yeah, seeing how this rotation shakes out, because look, they've got, you know, Gobert, Mitchell, Bogdanovich, Joe Ingles, Mike Conley, Royce O'Neal, Jordan Clarkson's back as well. Like, they have a lot of talent. Now add Favors into that mix. Like, that's a really good, solid top eight. Are they a championship contender? I don't know. But, like, could they?
I think it's fair to say no at this point, unless we see a significant step up from a guy we've never seen step up before.
Joe Ingles?
Yeah, anybody, really. Oh, okay. And we even saw that last year with Bogdanovich, who played his heart out. So, you know, I think it's reasonable to be skeptic about, you know, their championship aspirations, because, you know, the only guy you can somewhat expect to take a major leap is Donnie.
Yeah. And, I mean, we saw it in the bubble, especially in the playoffs, you know, him and Jamal Murray in that
Jamal
Nuggets.
Murray, yeah.
Yeah, and that Nuggets Jazz series were sensational. Yeah. So, you know, Do you think it's possible that Mitchell does have another leap in him?
Yeah, I actually do. And that's just, and that's not me being a Mitchell homer from back in the day.
Yeah.
But he's just so good that I cannot imagine him with his work ethic and the way that he moves, like his fluidity, that he doesn't have another level to reach.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't think the Jazz paid him that contract to stay the same.
Yeah.
I would be shocked. This is a guy who, you know, okay, so he went up 3.5 points per game over the course of two seasons, which is a marginal upgrade, but it doesn't really, that doesn't tell the whole story. He's a guy who teams just fear. When he has the ball in his hand, you can tell that the entire defense is just keyed in on him.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's worth noting, like, he is an elite free throw shooter now. Mm-hmm. Like, he stepped it up to 86%. That is elite territory. If that three-point shot becomes more reliable, which I don't see any reason why it couldn't, like, if he became a 39-40% shooter from downtown on the same volume, maintained the high free throw percentage, and maybe even got a little bit more in terms of volume, boom, there you go. He's a 28-point scorer. But that's not the whole story. It's the fact that when he came into the NBA, he was also built as a defender because he's got a strong frame. He's superbly athletic. And we saw him actually this year, or last year, get better defensively because Bojan Bogdanovic was taking over more of the offense. And you had Mike Conley taking over some more ball handling duties. So he was not the guy who had to do everything. And as soon as he wasn't that guy, he started going, oh, then I can contribute in other areas. Like, I'll move the ball around more willingly. I'll play harder defense on this possession because I haven't had to take the last three shots down the court.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have that energy now. So I wouldn't be shocked to see him taking a significant leap to this season. I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah, I honestly wouldn't either. And I'm intrigued to see how the Jazz shake out this year.
Yeah. I am too. I will say this, though. I am a little bit worried about his height.
Mm.
I know he did so well against Denver, but in fairness, he was being guarded by a very small Denver backcourt.
Mm-hmm.
So that just made it easier for him to get his shots off. I'm not saying that is what did it. Like, 57, you don't get 57 just because your opponent has a small backcourt. That's not how it works. Clearly, he's an elite shot maker and shot taker, but I do think at 6'1", which, you know, because he simply tested out lower when the NBA updated their heights,
mm-hmm.
That comes in at a little bit of a disadvantage. So if the Jazz goes up against like the Lakers or someone or the Clippers, where you have a LeBron or Kawhi or Paul George, or you can basically say, hey, you know what? One of you guys who are 6'8", 6'7", 6'9", whatever, go guard Donnie Mitchell. I think that would be problematic. So that's why I'm also a little bit concerned that even if he does take a step up, does he have the ability in the playoffs to consistently overcome much taller, longer defenders?
Yeah, that's fair. We probably don't need to spend a ton of time on the next team here because they are very clearly going into rebuilding mode. The Oklahoma City Thunder have shipped out Chris Paul. Technically, Danilo Gallinari left as a free agent. Dennis Schroeder's gone. Steven Adams is gone. That was four of their top 5 minutes getters from last year. So they have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. They have Trevor Ariza. They have Al Horford now. And that's about it. Horford was number one on Zach Lowe's list of guys who are inevitably going to bounce back this year. So what do you think the Thunder can get out of him?
Does it matter?
For eventual, the inevitable trade that they're going to do, either at the deadline or next offseason, can they get picks for him at some point? That's how they're thinking about it.
I guess they are. I don't know. That's very, very low on my things to watch this year.
admittedly. Me too.
But no, I am interested to see what Shai and Al Horford and Trevor Reese, to some extent, he's a bit older now, so he's not really. But I'm interested in seeing what they can do together. Mm-hmm. But more than that, I'm interested in seeing which player around those guys steps up. Mm. Like I've actually liked Isaiah Roby out of Nebraska. He's had 1 year in the league, wasn't really all that successful. I think actually he was drafted in. No, he wasn't 19 pick. For some reason, I'm thinking he was a year earlier in the Luka draft, but no, he was a 19 pick. He's a guy who is pretty good with the ball in his hands. I think he has an NBA future, so that's what I'm interested in seeing. I'm interested in seeing if Tyre Jerome can become something. Like even CJ Leaf, who's been disappointing, mm-hmm. I think he would be interesting. They got Admiral Schofield. He's a guy I like a lot. They have these guys, man, where you just kind of wonder, will one of those just break out and become something? You could also throw Darius Bazley.
Yeah, I was going to say. Of all the people, not today, you're naming, like, Admiral Schofield.
well, okay, to be fair, Bazley showed something, though.
Yeah.
This year. I mean, he was a little bit more established, right?
Well, and the same goes for Lou Dort, who was phenomenal, exactly. Especially against Harden in the playoffs. But yeah, I mean, I think that is more than can Al Horford not be absolutely terrible and rehab his trade value so they can dump him at some point. Yeah, I mean, this season for the Thunder is all about, you know, A, is SGA like a franchise centerpiece building block? And B, which of these young guys around him are worth keeping for the long term as well? So
I have a question about you, about these guys, by the way,
yeah.
or about the Thunder, which I think is pretty funny. Do they have their own pick for 2021?
I believe so, yeah. I think
okay.
I double-checked last night, and someone can triple-check me, but mm-hmm. I think between now and 2026, they have 15. They could have as many as 15 first-round picks and 3 additional pick swaps.
Right, but I'm talking about, like, their own
picks. Yeah, they have traded none of their own picks, and then they have as many as 9 from other teams coming in.
Okay. So, here's what's funny. 2021, if they win number one, out of all the picks that they've acquired, the most crucial pick that they can end up making over the course of this rebuilding process is their own pick for next year
yeah.
if they win number one.
Right, for sure.
Because that's Cade Cunningham.
Yeah.
Boom. And after they get him, you're not going to visit the number one overall pick again unless it's from the outside picks that they acquired.
Right. Yeah. No, it's going to be... I think that's the strategy, right? I mean, they
oh, yeah.
took a sledgehammer to this team. Like, I think there is no
they
question.
They pulled a
hinky. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think there's any question. If they're not the worst team in the West, they're going to be in the bottom 2 or 3, right?
Oh, I have to assume they're the worst team, arguably, in the NBA.
Yeah. I mean, again, like, I actually think Horford is going to rehab his trade value. I think a lot of his struggles last year were just based on the fit, and, like, I don't think he's completely washed as a player, although I praise God that I do not have to watch him clap after he misses a layup this year. So I think there is something there, but like they are just so bereft of proven talent otherwise that, mm-hmm. yeah, I think you're looking at, I mean, look, we know the draft lottery odds got flattened. So even if they have the worst record, there's no guarantee they get the number one pick. They only have a 14% right. chance at it. It's more likely than not that they won't get it, but you know, they'll give themselves a floor of a top 5, top 6 pick. So far, early reviews of this upcoming class seem to be higher than the one we just had. So,
right.
you know, it seems like they've set themselves up pretty well moving forward, even though this year is going to be pretty rough to watch.
I'm just realizing, is that is the Horford trade official?
No, not until Tuesday. Monday, Tuesday, whatever, December 8th. Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, gotcha. Which okay, is right before preseason. Okay.
Which is funny because throughout like Sixers media week, Doc Rivers was very careful about like not specifically mentioning Danny Green and his plans. Mm-hmm. But Ben Simmons today was just kept talking about Danny Green. And I'm like, oh, I guess this I don't know what the rules are for players. Is this tampering? I don't know. I hope he doesn't get fined for it.
It's all dumb. Yeah. It's all dumb. Yeah. Okay. But even if Al Horford returns to like the Al Horford we know, you know, his key component outside of his defense is his playmaking and passing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. But if he passes to guys who can't, like Terrence Ferguson and Lou Dort.
Terrence Ferguson is also going to the Sixers. So.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. That is true. That's why I didn't bring him up initially. Yeah. That's true. What about Hamidou Diallo? Because I didn't mention him because I actually didn't know what his status was.
As far as I know, he's on the team. Yeah, I mean, like, right. The Thunder, I honestly still don't know if I can name every single player on their roster because I just...
No.
Dust hasn't settled yet. But, I mean, they do have George Hill still, I think. So yeah. That's another playmaker off the bench. But yeah, you're right. There's not a ton in terms of proven offensive talent. I think this team is going to very, very badly struggle to score this year.
Hot take.
Yes.
In his third season, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander is going to average 27 a game.
He's going to have to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, boy, let's move on to the Houston Rockets, who we just talked about. In our previous episode with the Westbrook-Wall trade, so I don't think we need to go too far into that part of it again. If you want to listen to more analysis, just go back and check out that episode. But specifically with Wall, we should ask at least, like, how does he fit with Harden? Is he a better fit than Westbrook was, assuming he's healthy?
Yeah, assuming health, yes. He's not a guy who jacks up a lot of shots in the same Westbrookian way. So he is a pass-first guy, and I think that matters a great deal. He's a guy who does pick his spots a little bit better. Now, he's not really that active. He's one of those guys who moves the least of any player in the NBA. That is not great, and I don't think having torn over your Achilles is going to improve that.
Nope.
So you could look at that in one or two ways. You can say, well, that's a problem that he doesn't move a whole lot. That means he's not going to be as engaged in the offense. That means he's going to sometimes just check out. Or you could look at it as going, hey, that's a good thing, because that means that James can do whatever the hell he wants. That's fine.
Yeah. Or, I mean, if nothing else, it'll reduce wear and tear on him, maybe. So that's a positive.
Yeah.
The big other move they made, you know, they, in a convoluted, what ended up basically being a chain of events, but Covington was out, and then they got Ariza. They sent Ariza to Detroit for Christian Wood in a sign-in trade. I know you were super high on him last year heading into the season, and your faith in him worked. I mean, he was...
Oh, you had to swallow that one. This is the first time you've brought this up. Like, yeah, you made a good call, Mort.
Yeah, okay. No, I've given you credit for the Christian Wood pick before, but...
After I've asked for it.
Well, either way, how do you see him working with Harden in Houston?
It really depends on Harden, I think. You know, so Wood is just so long, and he's got really long legs, and that's one of the things that I liked about him, which is why I picked him for MIP last year. It's the way that he moves, right? He's just so cat quick. He's got this, when he takes a step, it's almost like Giannis. You know how much ground Giannis has covered when he's, you know, at full speed.
Mm-hmm.
Christian Wood is a little bit like that. If he gets a step on you, like, he really gets a step on you. He has that ability to take that one power dribble from outside the three-point line, and it ends up with a dunk. That's where he is. Like, he's just such a long athlete. So if James Harden kind of allows him to be a guy who can slip towards the basket and he'll find him on those cuts, great. Like, that, I could see that working out fantastically. Now, if Harden is more inclined to basically just use Wood as a sort of screener who needs to pop to optimize spacing for James himself, then I wouldn't like it as much. And I'm saying that fully realizing that Christian Wood is a good shooter. Like, for his career, he's at almost 37%. Last year was almost at 39%. You know, 74% from the free throw line. So there's a lot to like there from him as a shooter. But if he becomes a one-dimensional player, which sometimes under Harden you just become because of what it takes for Harden to be effective, that would be a major problem, I think, for Wood moving forward in his career. You want him to get, you know, interior buckets. You want him to get the ball close to the rim. You want him to cut to the hoop. You want to find him on alley-oops. He's a guy who needs to score close to the basket and then follow that up by hitting outside shots. He's not an outside-in player. He's an inside-out player.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, look, he's not the unicorn type big. I wouldn't put him in the Karl Anthony Towns, right. Anthony Davis range. You know, he does have some. He's not just Clint Capella, in other words. Like, he's right. more offensively gifted than that. So, you know, seeing how Harden did thrive with Capella, I mean, I think there is hope that, you know, with a springy big man like Wood, especially, they can work together. I don't think this is. You know, the Rockets' decision to trade Capella at the trade deadline last year was not Harden being incompatible with him. It was Westbrook, and Westbrook is now gone. So,
right.
You know, I think it, look, for what, for it wasn't even $14 million a year. Like, it's a great gamble by Houston, and it could be more than Wall and more than Boogie. Like, the Wood signing could be the thing that really helps them convince James Harden that they're on the right path moving forward. Right. The other, I think, big question for Houston is...
Wait. Can we wrap up Wood first?
Yeah. Go.
So, when we talk about analytics, I brought this up before. People always think, oh, threes. One of the things that they are forgetting is that, you know, the safe two is also a good analytics indicator. Mm-hmm. Like, if you shoot well on, like, layups and dunks and whatnot. Without looking, Brian... What field goal percentage do you think that Christian would have this past season inside of 3 feet?
Ooh. Based on that lead-in, makes me think it's going to be higher than I would have guessed. So I'm going to say 68%.
79.3.
Ooh, okay.
For his career, he's at 77. Wow. He is one of the great, you know, converters near the basket.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why I think, you know, Houston can still somewhat follow along the whole Morey Ball path, even if he's not there. I think Wood, in that sense, given how much he just at the rate that he converts 2-point shots near the basket, I mean, theoretically, if we simply ignore potential personality fit with Harden and Wood. I might be inclined to say, offensively speaking, it could be one of the best, you know, combinations of small and big that we have in the entire league next season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's where we are. The question is, can the Rockets sustain that? Can they build a team around that combination?
Right. And I think that's a big question with Eric Gordon in particular. More, you know, Wall and Boogie are just such question marks based on health. Eric Gordon, also not the picture of health necessarily, but at least he's played basketball in the last year and a half, so he's got that over those two. But he was just brutal last year, more 36.9% shooting, 31.7% from 3-point range, and he's locked up on a long-term deal. So, you know, they're going to have to, if they want to get out of him, they're going to have to shed probably at least one, if not two, first-round picks to get out of him. So he's most likely stuck there for a while. Do you have any hope of a bounce-back year from him?
I mean, I want to say yes, but it's just been trending downwards for a while now. It just hasn't been good. Efficiency-wise, he's been bad. I know that people are starting to say, oh, he's a better defender than he used to be, which is actually true. But it's not to the point where it's good. And I don't know why Vogue... I think Vogue is partly to blame because he called him some sort of like defensive-oriented guy or something on Twitter when he announced something and was like, no, that's not true. That's definitely not true. He's got a wide body, which does help him when he gets to the rim. But the thing is, he's just... he doesn't go there a whole lot. I mean, so if he doesn't go there a whole lot, you don't really get to take advantage of it. I'm a bit concerned. So I actually have another stat for you here as well. So last season, only 1.3% of Eric Gordon's offense came from 16 feet and between the three-point line.
Oh, boy.
What do you think his field goal percentage was?
30.
It's obviously very low.
Yeah, let's say 32%.
Zero.
Oh, good.
Zero. He made zero shots between 16 feet and the three-point line last season.
I mean, you know, I think the share of that is the Morey ball, right? Like, you're taking threes. And I guess that's one of the biggest questions with the Rockets, honestly, is now that Morey's gone and Mike D'Antoni's gone, do they stay as married to that style of play, or are they more open to taking a higher volume of mid-range shots? And, like, you know, does that get Eric Gordon going? Maybe, you know, long twos are inefficient in terms of your expected points per possession, but, like, if that is a shot he's more comfortable hitting instead of jacking 10 threes and hitting two or three of them per night, you know, is that the schematic tweak that you need to make?
It might be. Now, personally, I wouldn't bet on it. I would rather just give the minutes to Ben McLemore, who I actually think did well. I remember writing an article about him early last season after he had a hot start. And I was slightly worried after I published it, thinking, yeah, I jinxed it. He's probably going to drop off. He didn't. Like, he was a reliable 40% three-point shooter over the course of 71 games. He hit 181 of them. Granted, he doesn't really do a whole lot else but shoot freeze, because that's the way he decided to find an NBA role again. Mm-hmm. But he's 27. He's just more reliable. He's more athletic. He seems to be able to move much better than Eric Gordon at this point. So even if it would behoove the Rockets in the long term to find a way to get Eric Gordon going again, if you want to remain competitive, which I assume they will, otherwise they wouldn't have gone out to sign Christian Wood and they wouldn't be stingy about keeping James, I think, you got to go with the better player, right?
I would hope so. Well, right? We'll see soon enough.
Okay.
Let's go to the Denver Nuggets now, Mort. We've already talked a lot about Jeremy Grant and Mason Plumlee departing, so I'd say if you want to listen to that, go back and check out some of our free agent pods. Yeah. I think, you know, ultimately the Nuggets are going to come down to their top two, if not three guys, so let's start on the number three, Michael Porter Jr. He's kind of going to be forced into more of a sink or swim situation now with Grant gone in particular. We saw it in the bubble. He had games where he looked like an absolute star, but there were also games where he got completely roasted on defense, and that, you know, Mike Malone was not shy about criticizing that aspect of his game throughout the regular season and saying basically that's why his minutes are so low relative to his talent. Like, Mike Malone knows what this kid can do. He can develop into a star. But he's being very dogged about holding him accountable and saying, like, you're not going to play if you keep making these dumb mistakes. So what are your expectations for MPJ heading into year three?
So I want to be high on him because I want Denver to be good. I like Denver. I like Nikola Jokic. I think in the playoffs, they have a tendency to find another gear. And also, they have a tendency to be very, very entertaining. So I want that as an NBA pundit, observer, fan, analyst, whatever you want to call it. I want that to happen. But at the same time, I also have to be a realist. And that is, Michael Porter Jr., he can't really get out of his own way, right? It's not just the on-court mistakes. It's the fact that he just becomes such a... He gets so much media attention because of the things that he says off the court.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not going to go into, you know, which player, like, says anything. But I've been speaking to people about Michael Porter Jr. And I know for a fact that there are players in the organization who not necessarily a fan of how he conducts himself.
Mm.
Meaning, will there be that level of trust that you kind of need to have from your teammates if you're going to be a high volume scorer? I question that. There are, you know, players in the organization who still believe in him, are like, oh, he's just a crazy kid. But he definitely rubs a lot of people the wrong way, and that also goes for the opposition and the competition, because there are a lot of guys in the NBA, generally speaking, who felt that what he said over several occasions this year put a mark on his back.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, you know, this is really one of those, you know, waterfall effects. Because let's say this is his coming out party. This is like the year he's going to be good. And then let's say there are 20, 25 players in the NBA who've targeted the date when they play him.
Mm-hmm.
And they annihilate him. Well, what does that do to his confidence? Does that mean that he will progress worse or slower because he suddenly starts doubting himself?
Yeah.
Like, there are so many things, like so many ripple effects, you know, that could go on from this. And I think the best thing for him is just shut up, listen to what the coaches say, play the best game that he can, and then also have a short memory. If he has a bad game, don't live with it. Just mm-hmm. come back and then try your best one more time, because the Nuggets are going to need him. But it's just so important he doesn't make his own situation worse. And that is just what he's done repeatedly over the past year. So for him, it's just a matter of realizing, hey, I'm in a league where there are a lot of basketball players who are black. So maybe let me not say something that is going to rub black people the wrong way. That might be a good idea.
Or, I mean, I don't remember the exact quote, but it was during, I think it was during the Clippers series or the Jazz series. I think the Clippers series, right? Where he was saying basically, like, the offense, not enough guys were touching the ball. I mean, he was effectively implying that he wasn't getting enough shots, but he was basically saying the offense was running too much through Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic, and it's better if we have more ball movement and that kind of thing. And they admonished him for, you know, voicing that frustration publicly. But yeah, I mean, these are all just things he needs to learn. You know, it's part of the growth curve of becoming a regular starter and then hopefully a star one day is, you know, knowing which levers to pull behind the scenes, which ones to voice publicly. Like, you have to know that if you're saying that in a post-game press conference, that is going to be the headline for the next 2 days until your next playoff game, and there's going to be more focus on you in that game. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear that there are some players in the org that are, you know, at least skeptical of his demeanor. And you know, look, right now Nikola Jokic is an established all-NBA all-star, like annual all-star, all-NBA, you know, not front runner in MVP, but like on the fringes of MVP. Like, he is the foundational centerpiece of that team. And then Jamal Murray, we saw in the bubble, was just phenomenal. So I think that's the other big question for the Nuggets this year is, do we get bubble Jamal Murray for all 72 games? Or is this just like, we're just going to have to see every year. He'll be 80%, 90% of that during the regular season. And then once the bright lights go on, that's when we see this like dynamic superstar guard.
Yeah. I think that is definitely the biggest question for them coming in. That's what they have to figure out, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, what is he full-time? What is his floor? What is his ceiling? Which isn't unlike the same question that they're asking about Michael Porter Jr. Like, they have two guys where that question needs to be answered, right? Their success hinges dramatically on what that answer is going to be.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, they have one staple in that regard if you look at the top three, and that's Jokic. Like, you know what you're getting. Hopefully, Jamal Murray's performance in the bubble is a sign of what's to come. not only for the fact that he was a better player, but also it was super fun.
Yeah.
It was super fun. And I'll even say that about Porter Jr. as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he was on, he was objectively fun to watch. Like, that was entertaining basketball. Him coming down the court, pulling up from like a foot behind the three-point line and just draining it at 6'10". Like, sure, that gave me a little bit of KD flashback.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a matter of just being able to focus, I think. I think that's easier for Murray than it is Porter Jr., but... And find that level of consistency.
Yeah.
For Murray entering year four, right? No, wait,
year five.
Five. Yeah. Oh, God. See, we are getting old. Year five, of course. I think the time is now.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. I mean, the Nuggets paid him our $158 million for him to be that kind of a player. And, throughout the regular season, it was like, oh, okay, this is starting to look like it was a slight overpay. And then you get to the playoffs and it's like, oh no, that is the player. That is the 5-year max player. That he is living up to that kind of contract. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it well. This is kind of the question that's going to define their season is, what do you get out of Murray and MPJ every night? Because as you said, assuming Jokic shows up in shape, you know what you're going to get out of him, or he'll play himself into shape, and you know what you're going to get out of him. But if you can cut down on some of the variability with these other two guys, I think the Nuggets, by virtue of losing Grant, Plumlee, Torrey Craig, and, they brought in Jamichael Green, who will do an admirable job trying to replace Grant, but it's a downgrade there. Paul Millsap's not getting any younger. I think on paper, the Nuggets are worse in terms of overall talent than they were last year. Can Murray and Michael Porter Jr. help kind of, make up for that?
I think they can, but they have to be in the right mindset. And again, not to belabor the point, I just think the question is bigger for Michael Porter Jr. than it is Jamal Murray.
For sure.
He just needs to stop being controversial. And he needs to just put his game first, and that's the start. That has to be priority number one.
Yeah. So let's wrap up with the two LA teams. Mort, we'll start with the Clippers, who this week there's been a steady trickle of stories coming out about kind of what went wrong for them last year. I mean, it continues to sound like they just overly catered to Kawhi and Paul George, but then, Paul George is saying Doc Rivers also didn't use him in the right way, try to make him more of a spot-up shooter like J.J. Redick, and that's not his game. So do you think the change from Doc to Ty Lue, and do you think that disappointment from last year can help serve as fuel and kind of give them the foundation they need to make up for... they were supposed to be one of the title favorites last year, and they just flamed the F out.
So we agree that if a guy says, oh, my coach wanted me to run more off the ball, you would have to expect a dramatic increase in, 3-point field goal attempts, right?
I would think so.
Okay. So in his last year in OKC, Paul George, 46.9% of his shots were threes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that did increase, but only to 48.7 last year. Which makes me think, are you sure that that's a huge problem?
Right.
Like, are you? And to note, not to rub it in, but he kind of hit a career high of 41.2% from behind the arc.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe even if that was the mandate from Doc, is that a bad thing?
Right, like maybe Doc just knew what he was doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so they brought in Serge Ibaka in place of Montrezl Harrell, who went to the Lakers.
Yeah, that's an upgrade.
Yeah, that's because Montrez, sixth man of the year, was great throughout the regular season, really struggled in the playoffs, especially in that Nuggets series. And, that's one of the big criticisms that was levied against Doc was that, Zubac was playing well in that series. Montrez wasn't, and he was sticking with Montrez over Zubac. So,
yeah.
Do you think Ibaka, I don't think he's going to put up 18-7, but you think, you know, even in the smaller, even though his per game stats will likely be worse than Montrez's were last year, he's going to be a better fit for this team?
Yes, absolutely, because Ibaka actually has center size and he can hit threes as well. He's just a more unique player. I think one of the things that we have done as an NBA community over the past few years is forget just how brilliant Serge Ibaka is. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who is a tremendous defender. He is, he's never an elite rebounder, but he's not a net negative necessarily in that aspect. He is a great mid-range shooter. He's a good three-point shooter. He will still finish around the rim. He'll pass. Like, he's not one of those guys who racks up huge assist numbers, but that doesn't really matter because he does make proper reads. Like, he's a smart, intelligent basketball player. And while Montrez gives you a lot of energy and athleticism and all that, a lot of it is flash. And I'm not saying he's not a skilled basketball player, because of course he is. But compared to Ibaka, like, the fundamentals, like, you can't compare them. Like, Ibaka is worlds ahead just in terms of his overall skill set. So I consider that a significant upgrade from where they were at. And considering they got equal contracts, Clippers.
Well, and I mean, Serge Ibaka not only has played with Kawhi before, but he won a championship with Kawhi. So we know that that particular fit works well. I mean, I'm with you. I think it's going to be, you know, they are more versatile because they have Ibaka instead of Montrez, even though, again, like, his stats are not going to be as good as what Montrez had. But the other big upgrade they made was, you know, they traded Landry Shamet in a three-team deal on draft night and got Luke Kennard, who, if healthy, is just a much more dynamic player than Shamet. So how do you see Kennard fitting in? Do you think he starts at the two next to Kawhi and Paul George, or are they going to stick with Marcus Morris, you know, this three-wing lineup of Kawhi, Paul George, Marcus Morris, and bring Kennard off the bench?
So had he not signed for that contract, Marcus Morris, I would have said Luke Kennard, but I can't imagine a $16 million player not starting, right?
Yeah, I would assume so. Or maybe Ty Lue does it on a matchup-by-matchup basis. Uh-huh. But, yeah, like, my gut tells me it's going to be Beverly in the three wings in the starting lineup, and then Lou Williams and Kennard off the bench is just instant offense.
Yeah. See, my preferred lineup there, and I'm not talking about starting lineup, so it might, you know, change just in terms of how they finish games. Mm-hmm. It would actually be Subac at the five, Ibaka at the four, because keep in mind, even though he has center size, he came into the league as a four. So he can play that big position. Now, I'm usually not fond of traditional power forwards, but when they can shoot and defend, I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. Like, that makes a world of difference. And then, of course, Kawhi and PG in whatever capacity at the wings. And then Pat at the one, I think. Like, that just makes the most sense, right? But, well,
I mean, they have it's similar to what I said with Covington and the Blazers earlier. Ibaka gives them more flexibility than when Montrez did, because Montrez he's so good in pick and rolls, but he is much more limited offensively than a guy like Ibaka, who, as you said, he can actually stretch the floor and hit threes.
Right.
So, you know, if they want to go small ball, they could put Ibaka at the five and do Kawhi and Paul, and then Kennard at the two, Pat Bev or Reggie Jackson at the one. If they want to go big, they can do your lineup with Ibaka at the four, Zubac at the five. You know, if they're going against a Lakers team starting Anthony Davis and Marc Gasol, that might be their best play. So, yeah, having that sort of versatility and able to go small, go big, depending on who you're going against. We probably won't see it a ton during the regular season. I mean, coaches just often don't alter their lineups like that on a matchup-by-matchup basis in the regular season. But in the playoffs, I think it's going to be a big weapon for them.
Yeah. No, I agree. I hope for their sake, though, they do play Subac a lot.
Yeah.
I think it's his time. You know, he's on my short list of MIP candidates. So.
Oh, interesting. So,
Yeah.
No, I mean, look, he was really, really good in the limited minutes that he played. And, you know, he is not going to give you a ton offensively other than clean the glass, get putbacks, get lobs. But that's okay because you have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Like, you have two high usage guys in your starting lineup. And if you have Lou and Luke Kennard off the bench, like, you don't need Zubac taking 20 shots a game. In fact, you don't want Zubac taking 20 shots a game. So having a low usage offensive center is fine. Just defense, you know, especially going against a Jokic or a Gasol or an Anthony Davis, like, you're going to have to Gobert. Like, you need an actual center who is, you know, confident and knows his role well by the time the playoffs roll along. So yeah, Zubac, I think, is, you know, probably the X factor for this team, the one that, like, no one's going to really focus on, but he could end up kind of determining how far they go. Just, you know, if he comes to the playoffs totally unprepared, that's going to limit their versatility.
Yeah, I would agree. Do you think that they actually signed Marcus Morris to this deal with the mindset of potentially moving him later?
God, I don't know. It's just a lot of money for Marcus Morris, and I feel like it flew under the radar because everyone's just so focused on the Gordon Hayward contract being an abomination. But
This is bad. Yes, but yeah. I have to assume, though, that they paid him this type of money because there were other teams willing to pay the same, right?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know which team was willing to pay. Like, the Knicks didn't even give him a 4-year deal last year. They gave, I think it was 1 year, 15, right?
Yeah. Well, a 2-year deal, I think, with an option, yeah, but, right? Was it? Yeah. But you're right. No, but my thinking is, like, let's say the Clippers have heard there were 4 teams willing to give him a deal of this vicinity.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. they had no way to replace him if he left.
Right, and then if they re-signed him, they would know, okay, we have 4, you know, trade candidates potentially that could take him off our hands half a year if now.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I hope so.
Yeah, right, for their sake. All right, well, let's pivot since we were just talking about Montrez. Let's wrap up with the Lakers, who we have discussed a lot this offseason. Obviously had a great offseason bringing in Montrez, Schroeder, Wes Matthews, re-signing Anthony Davis, re-signing LeBron, re-signing KCP.
I mean, I have nothing to add. We, like you said, we covered them so thoroughly on this podcast. So what is there left? What is there more to say?
So I have two questions with them that have arisen in recent weeks. One, I've been surprised to hear how many people don't like the Montrez conceptual fit with LeBron and Anthony Davis. And I can get it to some extent, but do you think the Marc Gasol signing changes the perception of Montrez's role on this team?
Yeah, absolutely. Because now you'll have a guy who was a former DPOY, who is a guy who still is a good defender. He'll come in and he'll take the tough matchup off the bench, or even as a starter. It depends on what happens there. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that responsibility now falls upon Trez whatsoever. Like, he can just be the guy who comes in and gives you points and puts pressure on the defense by setting screens and diving. I don't hate the conceptual fit. I do think he's limited in a certain way. I think he is a predictable player, but I don't think that's a problem considering what they paid him.
Right.
I mean, this was a guy who won six man. Like, okay, six man's popularity contest, all adding up in points, so doesn't even matter. But he gave, what did he give him? Like 18.5 and 7 boards, right?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Okay, that's not bad production. And you have to look at the grand scheme here. You know, this isn't necessarily just about how you optimize Montrez or Marc Gasol. This is also about, hey, LeBron and Anthony Davis, we really like you guys because you won us a championship. We want your legs to be fresh in the playoffs and in the finals. So in the regular season, you know what? You're just going to be playing 30 minutes a game, 32 minutes a game if you're persistent. and you can just coast a little bit against the bad teams. We'll put Tress in. He'll get his 18 to 22 points. He'll be happy. It's fine.
Right. I don't expect Montrez playing 30-plus minutes per game in the playoffs. I think he's definitely more... He's more of the... Well, I guess we have to call him 72-game players this year instead of 82. But he's more of a 17-game player than a 16-game player. But as you said, especially given the wear on LeBron and AD's legs, you know, short turnaround from the bubble, yeah, just let Montrez go wild off the bench. Save your, you know, save LeBron, save AD. Like, you're going to have a much more dynamic scoring presence off the bench than you did last year, which is a win. The other question I have is, I don't know if you saw, Dennis Schroeder spoke with the media a few days ago and was talking about how he's like, he does not want to come off the bench this year. He wants to be in the starting lineup. What do you think of that?
What do you mean what I think of that?
Do you think the Lakers should oblige? Like, should they start Dennis Schroeder or should they have him come off the bench still?
Is he their best point guard on the roster?
Do you count LeBron James as a point guard?
I don't.
Okay, then yes. But, I mean, that's what I'm asking. Like, do you think they should have, you know, they didn't technically have a point guard in their starting roster, or the starting lineup last year, unless you consider Avery Bradley that type of player. But, you know, they ran their offense through LeBron and then let Rondo come off the bench as their, like, traditional point guard there. So, I mean, you know, if you're the Lakers, you can do a LeBron, AD, Marc Gasol, KCP, and Wes Matthews starting lineup, or you could have Schroeder instead of probably Wes Matthews at that point.
Yeah. Look, Schroeder isn't even a traditional point guard, so to speak. He's a point guard, but he's not a guy who... You know, there are many variations of a point guard nowadays, or a shooter, like in every position, really. So, for me, I'm thinking he can just move off the ball, he can be a shooter, he can be a scorer. LeBron can still be the primary point forward, whatever the hell, basketball player. Basketball right. who initiates the offense. So Schroeder, I don't care. I don't care if he plays like a traditional point guard game because it doesn't matter. Just let him shoot. Let him score. And, you know, just because he starts alongside LeBron and AD doesn't mean he has to play all the minutes with them. Right. It doesn't mean that. So let's say midway through the first quarter, you know, LeBron, AD is like, oh, okay, you guys, you're, you know, at least LeBron, you're about to turn 36. Let's get you off the floor. Let's get you off the floor a little bit. And then we're going to push it back in the second quarter. Fine. Then in the meantime, you just let Dennis take over with Montrez. Okay. Fine. I don't see a problem with it. The whole starting debate to me is really just an ego battle.
Right. Well, I think that's the concern. If you're from the Lakers' perspective, I'm not saying this is going to like derail their season or anything like that, but...
No, but oblige him. You can figure it out, though.
Well, I'm just, like, you're joining a team that just won a championship. If they think your best role is off the bench, you're going to have to sacrifice, and you have to come off the bench. Like, you know, Dwight Howard... came in, got humbled, and bounced around the league for a couple of years.
Yeah, that's a different scenario, though.
It is, but like he's still very talented. I mean, we saw a couple of years ago he could still put up 17 and 12 just on a bad team. Like, but then you go to a team like the Lakers, and they say, we know what you can do, but we don't need you to do this. Here's what you need to do. We need you in a smaller role, 10 to 15 minutes or 15 to 20 minutes a game off the bench. Play good defense, protect the rim, rebound, get the occasional putback. That's it. So if the Lakers come to Schroeder and say, we think your best role is coming off the bench, pairing with Montrez, like you'll still play with LeBron and AD, and you know, you're saying starting is overrated. I agree, because it like just because he doesn't start doesn't mean he won't finish games. I think that should be the bigger concern.
But doesn't matter, though. Like you can stagger minutes. That's why you have a rotation.
Yeah. It was something that caught my eye. Again, not that it's going to totally derail their season or anything like that, but...
Oh, my God. You sound like such a traditionalist right now. Like, they won the championship. They have to sacrifice. Like, dude, Dennis Schroeder played under 31 minutes a game He averaged 19 points and 4 assists, and it was a playoff team he was on. So it's not like he put up big numbers on a bad team. Like,
I know.
And look, again, it doesn't matter. Like, theoretically, you can start him, and then you can just figure it out. Like, if it keeps a happy locker room, it's fine. Like, look, I kind of get it. The whole idea of having multiple six men, like, I even wrote an article about this for Forbes, basically saying, hey, you know what? The future is in to having two six men. And I still overwhelmingly believe in that. But at the same time, if your primary option at the guard spot is KCP or Alex Caruso, guess what, man? I'm going to go with Dennis Schroeder.
Yeah.
That's fine. Like, if they had a player of his caliber ahead of him, yes, you and I would have been in total agreement. But they don't. The drop-off is so significant, I just don't care.
I guess we'll see how it plays out. I mean, I'm wondering if we get into this the same... There's only one ball, and you have LeBron and AD, two high-usage guys. Like, maybe you don't want another high-usage guy in the starting lineup. Maybe it's good to have people like KCP and Wes Matthews who can just be more low-usage catch-and-shoot threats.
But didn't he shoot more, like, as a spot-up, Dennis, that is?
Last year?
Let me just go check, because I seem to remember reading an article months and months and months ago saying that he... got assisted on way more shots, and that was part of why he was so effective. So, okay.
Yeah.
So, on his 3-point shots, and I have to assume for the Lakers specifically that his 3-point attempts is going to increase because that was an area of need.
Right.
Last season, he was assisted on 84% of his threes. Like, okay. I can see that. Like, maybe he won't get as many pick and roll chances. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. If all he cares about is starting, then he should also be fine with just being more of a spot-up shooter.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's something I will be keeping my eye on if he's willing to actually play the role that's best suited for him on this team.
Do that, Detective Toporek.
Well, it's just, again...
That was hard to say, by the way.
Yeah,
don't ever become a detective. That's horrible.
Don't worry, I chose a much more lucrative profession.
That's true.
On that enlightening note, I think that's a good place for us to wrap up, Mort. So thank you all for listening, as always. Please check us out on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we recorded this live on the Locker Room app. So if you are on iOS, download the Locker Room app. You can come hang out, ask us questions live. It's a ton of fun. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Don't die, man.
Thank you.